Coastal Interviews on this September 15th, 2009, and I have as my guest Terry Riley, the composer, groundbreaking composer. Terry, where are you?
I live up near Camptonville, California, in the Sierra Nevada.
Okay, and that's where you are now?
That's where I am now. Yeah.
Okay. And I also have Dave Jordan, who is the webmaster at Walala Arts Center, and also the bassist for Cloudfire, a local world music superb group, and the lighting master at the Whale and Jazz Festival every April at the Walala Arts Center. And Dave's going to do the interview, Dave being a Terry Riley devotee. I don't think so. Okay, Dave, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Okay, thanks, Fred. Terry Riley is a well-known composer for symphony orchestras, string quartets, saxophone quartets. He's also a singer of Indian ragas. He plays a mean ragtime piano. He's equally at home and equally respected in concert halls, jazz clubs, and piano bars. Terry, welcome to the Tide. Since we're in Walala, let's start right here. You attended a concert by Kronos Quartet at the Walala Arts Center last month, at which they performed a world premiere of one of your recent compositions, The Welcoming Baptism of Sweet Daisy Grace. Could you tell us something about that particular piece of music, and then back up and tell us about your longstanding musical relationship with the Kronos Quartet?
The Welcoming Baptism of Sweet Daisy Grace was written for my newest granddaughter, Daisy Grace Riley, and it came at a time when I was writing another quartet for Kronos, the Transylvanian Horns, which was a piece for strow instruments, which are these specially modified string instruments that don't have a body but use a bell, much like a gramophone bell or a trumpet bell, to amplify their sound, give them a certain kind of resonance. And as I was writing this, David Harrington said, why don't you write some music also that's just for the normal quartet instruments? And so that's how I got sidetracked onto the Sweet Daisy Grace Quartet. And as I have, you know, in my long association with Kronos, there's been a lot of personal references to all of our families, members of the quartet, and mine over the years as I've written pieces for them. For instance, when David Harrington's son was suddenly died on the top of Mount Diablo on an Easter Sunday on his 16th birthday, when he was 16, I wrote a requiem quartet called Requiem for Adam for that occasion. And in The Cusp of Magic, which is a piece that I wrote for Wu Man, the great Chinese people player, I included David's granddaughter's name as one of the movements, which is called Emily and Alice. And Alice is the daughter of the Kronos manager. Anyway, so there's been a lot of family references and other ones, too, that I've done over the years with Kronos. So Daisy Grace was the latest in that kind of
The Requiem for Adam is a wonderful emotional piece, and knowing what it was about made it overwhelmingly emotional to hear it. I heard it right when Kronos was first performing it in the Bay Area, and I was amazed that David Harrington could even play the piece.
It was a really heroic thing for him to do, actually. And there were times I've been at performances when he felt like he got right to the limit of his ability to stay on the stage. And there was one story that happened when we were doing it in Saarbrücken, might have been the first performance, or was the first European performance, but it was one of the early ones. And right in the very end of the movement, which is one of the most emotional, the last movement is one of the most emotional movements, a helicopter flew over the concert hall, and it was quite loud, and David freaked out because that was what happened on top of Mount Tamalpais. I'm sorry, Mount Diablo, when the helicopter came to airlift Adam off the mountain when he had died. So there was this kind of moment there that I think that was, those kind of things for David made it so hard that I don't think they've played the piece now for quite a long time.
Earlier you wrote Salome Dances for Peace for the Kronos Quartet. And if I remember right, that was nominated for a Grammy and also made a lot of the top 10 lists for classical albums that year. Could you talk some about, and then you toured with them performing that piece?
Yeah, that Salome Dances for Peace was kind of an interesting period of my life. I was working on that and the Harpoon Albion, which is one of my large jazz intonation piano pieces, at the same time, and they kind of cross-fertilized each other in terms of like the, since I was playing in just intonation all the time with the piano, I was really hearing these kind of intervals in the quartet too. And the melodies that came out of the just intonation work and the piano actually ended up, many of them, getting into Salome Dances for Peace. It was conceived as a full-length ballet, and I actually wrote a synopsis of the whole plot of the idea of Salome being reincarnated in some future era as a force for good. And I don't know why that idea came to me to do that, but that's what happened. So I had to write a story about how all this happened. So I did kind of make a fable, which has her associating with different shamans and going into the underworld and having battles with demons there. And she had found out that peace had been stolen from the earth, why we didn't have any up here, because it had been stolen by the war demons, taken to the underworld, so she's sent down there to rescue peace. It's a little bit like the Orpheus fable, but it's got a different twist. And anyway, what I wanted to see was this performed at the United Nations with Kronos. At the time, we weren't actually in a war, but it has always felt like since Vietnam that we were on the verge of, because there were always warlike little actions happening all the time, and I really wanted to make a piece, a work that did express a desire for peace, because knowing so many people in the world long for it, not only the ones in war-torn countries, but I think Americans are probably pretty tired by now of always being in conflict with other nations in the world.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
You mentioned just intonation and the Harp of the New Albion. There's actually a local connection in Wallala to just intonation. Back in the 1930s, Harry Partch, the well-known California composer who was a big advocate of just intonation, lived here in Wallala for a while. Could you explain briefly what just intonation is and then what attracts you to performing, playing music in just intonation?
Well, just intonation is a very old system of tuning. It's not actually a system. It's the way that tones actually exist in nature. All the intervals in just intonation could be said to be derived from the overtone series. So when you strike a tone, it has a series of harmonics above that tone, which give that tone its particular timbre and quality. Your voice, for instance, has harmonics which make your voice sound like different than other voices, and a flute, for instance, has only even harmonics, so it makes it sound different than a oboe, which has mostly odd harmonics. So these properties, anyway, were studied by musicians in the ancient times, and Pythagoras did some work with his monochord in defining the particular intervallic relationships that were pure on the monochord. That means that the interval does not have beats in it. It has a true resonance, and it has the best way for someone to conceive of it is kind of like the sound has an aura around it because of this purity. If you play the same interval, like say you play a fourth in just intonation, it has a particular kind of very satisfying resonance. If you play it on the piano, you'll hear a kind of fuzziness because the interval is not perfectly in tune. It's adjusted to equal temperament, which is a way of making each tone equal distant from another, so you can play in every key. But with the ancient musicians and a lot of the world musicians, that's not a concern for them to modulate. So just intonation is the most natural system. Folk singers often will sing in just intonation. Old choirs, medieval music, old church music, much of the music of Africa, all of the music of India, China, these are all composed in just intonation because they're modal musics and they need perfect frequencies to achieve their most dynamic effect. It's a little bit hard for people to get if you hear it, you can, if somebody plays an interval, a perfect third, for instance, in just intonation, a person will say, oh yeah, but a lot of times the Western will say that sounds a little out of tune because they're used to the tuning that's used in the piano or that most Western instruments are tuned to. So it's the thing that if you hear it, you'll notice that there's a particular resonance in that interval which makes it very attractive and satisfying in itself. It almost doesn't need any other music around it. So you get composers like Lamont Young who just work with the intervals themselves without even creating melodies. They just use the intervals and let the resonances speak for themselves.
So in your piece, the Harp of the New Albion was played on a piano that was tuned in just intonation, and the good news was that as long as you were playing with the tonal center that piano was tuned to, it was perfectly in tune, but you couldn't play it in any other key.
Well, that's partially correct. You can actually modulate to other key centers, but you can't play, for instance, you can't play something that's basically written for equal temperament, like the Beethoven Sonata or Mozart Symphony. You'd have to have a lot of more intervals than are found on the piano to achieve a perfect tuning for every intervallic. Because what happens when you play, for instance, a piece like Beethoven, some of the intervals will be wildly out of tune in just intonation because they're not meant to relate to the particular note that you've modulated to. But I found, like, when I was working with the Harp of New Albion, I used several different key centers in it. And each key center had its own particular flavor and atmosphere. It had a kind of a feeling to it, so because of the difference of intervals. You get something that's not homogenized like equal temperament, where all the intervals have kind of a similar quality to them. Here they really have drastically different qualities to them. And the reason is that there's just not much more music in the West written in just intonation. It's quite a painstaking process to retune the instruments and then to, for instance, if you're doing a piano concert, you usually have to tune the piano several days beforehand so that the piano can adjust to the new tensions. So you just can't walk into a hall and play in just intonation. You have to prepare it.
When you're singing, say, an Indian raga, would you say that you're singing in just intonation, or is it really just a whole different set of scales?
Well, Indian ragas are all in just intonation. That is, all the interval. Raga is essentially just a melodic form of music. There's not harmonic movement in raga like we have in the West. So you have a drone, which in my case, it's a tambura, which is a four-stringed instrument that's tuned to the fundamental pitch and the fifth, or the fundamental pitch and the sharp seventh degree of the scale. so that you're always singing in relationship to these pitches. And that's why, you know, ragas, the qualities of different ragas are made by the shape of these intervals, the size of these intervals will really determine the effect of that raga. And they're minute shadings of pitch, like they call them shrutis. These minute shadings actually give the emotional qualities to the ragas and their flavor. It's quite an interesting science. We don't really have anything like it in the West because our music has been so driven by harmonic movement that we don't have these subtleties of melodic shapes.
Maybe we should go back a ways and talk about, could you tell us about your teacher, Pandit Pranath, and how did he influence your musical life?
Yes. Well, Pandit Pranath was one of the most extraordinary musicians and human beings of my life, for sure, and of many other people's, too. He was a very traditional master of Indian classical music. He was a vocalist. He was born in 1918 in Lahore, which was then India, but after 1947 became Pakistan. Lahore was a seat of high culture and music in India, and he had wonderful opportunities as a child to learn from many great musicians, because his family were wealthy and they invited musicians into their home to perform. And so he got very, very immersed in music at an early age. And when he was about 12 years old, his mother wanted to send him to England for an education, and he said no. He only wanted to be a singer. So she said, no, you can't do that. So he ran away from home and wandered around India for a long time. Of course, left the wealth of his family and just walked out with a T-shirt and on his back and wandered around looking for a teacher to teach him Indian classical music. And he met this great Ustad, Abdul Wahid Khan Saab from Kerala. And he, you know, begged him to have lessons. And, of course, in a lot of times in Indian classical music, the great teachers, they first teach their family and then they teach special disciples that somehow gain their favor. So Pranath, being a poor boy, wandering boy with no money or anything by this time, had a hard time convincing Abdul Wahid Khan Saab, you know, that he should take him on as a disciple. But finally he won him over, and he was with him for about 20 years and became the foremost disciple of this great tradition of Kerala, which is a small village in India, but a center of great learning for raga. And so Pranath was, wandered around India after that and had many jobs teaching at Delhi University. He was in Bombay for a while. And in 1970, Lamont Young got a grant for him to come to the United States, because we had actually heard his music from one of his disciples, Shyam Bhatnagar, who brought his tapes of Pranath's music to the USA in probably around 1968. People like in New York, where I was living at the time, were starting to hear Pranath's voice, and we were tremendously impressed. We'd never heard a singer like that. There was a quality in his voice that was unlike any other singer we'd heard. And I wasn't at that time aware too much of, you know, I'd been listening to other Indian singers, but I wasn't aware that there was this kind of old tradition which was had a different feeling to it. It's very profound, it's very deep, and immediately when you're in this atmosphere of this music, you almost naturally will fall into a meditative state. So anyway, Pranath came to the USA, and Lamont had set up some teaching for him at the New School for Social Research. And I was living, by that time I'd moved back to California, and they brought him out here, and I became his disciple. And then I went back to India and spent the next 6 months with him in 1970, beginning to learn this music, and very long and path it's been. That was 1970, now we're almost 40 years later, I'm still doing it. But he was also the teacher of many other, besides Lamont Young and I. Don Cherry became, you know, a student of his, and Lee Konitz took lessons. There are a lot of musicians who were, you know, jazz musicians who were very interested in his music. John Hassell, who's a musician in L.A., learned his particular trumpet style, now developed after hearing Pranath and studying with Pranath. So he was a big influence on the circle of musicians that I was involved in. And he was a great teacher, you know, to come from a tradition that's so different. And you know, at the beginning, he didn't have a lot of English skills. He had to do it all by just demonstrating the music. So he was able to get us all going in this music in quite a rapid way.
And at some point, Pranath became an instructor at Mills College.
Yeah, I was... I think 1971, I was in Europe touring with Pranath, and I got a call from Bob Ashley, who's a composer from New York, and he was teaching at Mills at the time, and asked me if I wanted to come to Mills and teach. So I took that job, and then as soon as I got there, I started lobbying for having Pranath as on the faculty too, because I thought it'd be such a wonderful opportunity for students to have this contact. And Mills College brought him on the faculty, and he taught there for about 10 years. We actually established a little department of Indian vocal music during that time.
And then, is that also where you met David Harrington?
Right, right. David came to Mills around 1980 with his quartet, and they were in residence there for about a year, and then finally, and we met right away. In fact, I was on the selection committee to bring them there, and I strongly urged them to bring Kronos there because I thought they were the most exciting young string quartet I'd heard. And so they were there for about a year, though, before we started working together.
And while you were studying, or in the early years that you were studying with Pranath, you actually gave up on composition for a while, and everything that you focused on improvisational music and learning the traditional Indian ragas. And then you started, through composed music again, working with David Harrington and Kronos Quartet.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually hadn't given up composing, but I just wasn't writing anything down because I was so enamored of the style of Indian learning of, you know, it's an oral tradition and people just memorize things and do them. And that fit me really well. And I'm more oriented towards ear than eye. So reading music and writing music are more difficult for me to do. But David talked me into, I hadn't been writing for about 10 years, writing anything down, although I had been composing a lot of music for myself to play. So David kept after me to write some string quartet music, and I finally got around to it in early 80s. My first two pieces for them were G-Song and Sunrise of the Planetary Dream Collector.
That's an interesting distinction between whether you're composing or whether you're writing it down. When you were not writing it down, was the music, did you have every note composed, or were you improvising within a compositional structure?
Yeah, I would build them up, you know, section by section at a time, as just through practice. And you know, the advantage to that is that sections could be interchanged or moved around, and it would each performance would be different, and that's very much in the spirit of the way raga is done. So, you know, you could actually create a long, the Harpanu Alveon was done this way too. you know, it's a two-hour work, but it was done just one little section at a time. And there's no real score for that. I just had to, you know, I just learned to memorize. It wasn't, I don't know, even memorization is not even the right word. It was kind of like, it's very much more like the way jazz musicians go. You have all little kinds of modules, and you start building them together, and they make a bigger form. And then you add modules to that, and they split off and become another section. And it's very much more the way something like jazz would work.
And that's also starting to define one of the forms of composition for which you became very well known back in the 1960s. You wrote In C, which many people thought was a revolutionary work, because among other things, it asserted the value of tonality in music at a time when academia in this country and in Europe was dominated by atonality and serialism. And it was based on just what you were saying of small motivic fragments that were then worked out on the fly by a group of musicians playing together.
Right.
Could you talk about...
That actually happened before I started studying Indian music, so I was already headed in that direction, that way of thinking.
You mentioned one of the people that studied with Pran Nat was John Hassell, and I know that he's performed your work because he was one of the performers on the original recording of In C back in the 60s. Have you ever worked with him since then?
No, we haven't. I mean, you know, we've known each other for years and years, but we actually haven't done anything, mainly because, you know, I've never lived around any place where he is. So well, I see him very seldom, you know, once in a while. He lives in Los Angeles. When I go down there, we get together. But we haven't actually done any music projects together. Talked about it, but it just hasn't happened yet.
Well, I would encourage you to think about that. I happen to be a big fan of John Hassell's as well,
yeah.
So I can't imagine what the two of you would come up with together.
No, I can. I think it would be a very nice way to work.
Could you talk a little bit about minimalism and what is the basic idea of minimal music, and how has that shaped your work over the years, and what does it mean to you today?
Well, you know, the minimalism was a term that was brought to the music after the music was done. And, of course, it wasn't in my mind that I was doing minimalism when I was composing pieces like In C or any of the early work that I was doing. I think it was... To me, it was a way of centering myself, using just repetition and ideas that are sustained tones or things that had restricted musical parameters in a certain way, instead of having a form that, you know, where you have all these different elements in the music, music that's very cluttered with different kinds of rhythms and harmonies and stuff. I felt comfortable with music that was kind of stripped away where I could get deeper. I mean, it's very much like the analogy of water, you know, when it's moving slow, you can really get deep in, it forms deep pools, and music does a similar thing. One way to slow down music was repetition, and because the repeated, emotive repeated over and over again, sort of becomes static, becomes stationary, even though it has gradually changing aspects happening to it. They're happening slowly. So I think this is the basis of minimalism, as a way to hear more deeply, to hear things that you wouldn't notice as music, you know, if music is flowing by in a faster way. There are things that go by unnoticed, but with a lot of musicians were starting to wanting to hear something that they hadn't noticed before. Listen for things they hadn't noticed before. So I think that's you know, that's kind of what attracted to a lot of people to it. But I don't like the term minimalism because it's too academic sounding again. To me, it had more to do with psychedelia and the experiences of smoking pot or taking mushrooms or LSD, and that little the ordinary becomes extraordinary.
You talked about the repetition slowing things down or forming a stasis. You've talked about eternity, and in fact, you were part of, with Lamont Young, you were in the theater of eternal music. Is that part of the same idea?
Well, I think that, you know, when I met Lamont, we were students at Berkeley in the early 60s, around 1960, and he had been, from the years before I had met him, had been working with long tones, and he used to talk about getting inside of a tone. And to me, that was a really eye-opening experience to have met him and start working with him, because his concept was different than any of the other musicians I had known up to that time. I think that he got this, I don't know how this came to him, he got it kind of just through his genes or something, this extraordinary concept of music that is even to this day unlike anybody else's. It had to do a lot with just getting inside of a sound, listening very deeply to a sound. And that's a lot of something that'll, you know, people sometimes don't slow themselves down enough to do.
And you mentioned the psychedelic aspect of your music, and probably the other very well-known piece of yours that's people call psychedelic was Rainbow in Curved Air, which was late 60s?
Yeah, it was Rainbow in Curved Air was 68. I was living in New York at the time that I wrote that, and Rainbow in Curved Air and Poppy No Good and the Phantom Band were recorded for CBS right after we did NC. So that was kind of a nice opportunity. All the things I've been working with for the years preceding that, suddenly I had a chance to reach a wider audience with it.
And among the people you reached with that were Pete Townsend from The Who.
Yeah.
Who named Bob O'Reilly partly in honor of you.
And Mayor Baba is his guru, yeah.
And Mayor Baba.
Yeah. Yeah. My music did make it over to the UK, and it was, I think, a lot of the rock musicians, almost all of them, you know, the ones around that, Pink Floyd, and I'm sure the Beatles and everybody knew about it. And, of course, I was doing tape loops, too, which was interesting because the Beatles were working with tape loops at that time and repetition, and their music was, they had, you know, they had the opportunity to reach millions with similar ideas. So it kind of excited me when I saw that the impact of the Beatles' music on the world and how they were changing the way people were listening. They were actually doing experimental things, but selling millions of albums doing it, and that's a very unique phenomenon. You don't see that very often.
And so that's a similarity between NC and Rainbow in Curved Air and the other things that you did in that time period, that both of them had a strong repetitive aspect to them.
Yeah, they're basically, like NC has 53 different repeating modules, and Rainbow and Curved Air only had a few. It was a piece that was built out of, you know, very simple means, all the modules went through so much variation that it sounded like there was more material than there was. But that's kind of like, I think it's kind of like the concept of fractals, you know. It's an infinitely replicating a process of a pattern, and in all of its forms of augmentation and diminution. So this was something that really fascinated me in music, especially at that time, it still does. It's a very difficult thing to achieve, but when it happens, it's quite phenomenal.
And fractals are a mathematical form, but they're descriptive of the way the natural world actually works.
Yeah. I'm not an expert in fractals, but they're supposed to be everywhere.
Self-similarity on different scales.
Yes.
Have you ever tried composing something that was deliberately based on the fractal concept, of where the structure of the overall piece was similar to the structure of a small motivic fragment, which was similar to a note? I don't know if I'm describing that well.
Well, you know, you're onto something very good there. I have thought about it a lot. I'm not sure how achievable it is in music because of the bandwidth of our hearing. So probably a lot of what would happen would be happening out of the bandwidth of audible sound, if you had these replicating patterns that were, each one had an arm that was a little smaller than the next one going into infinity. You would soon probably work your way out of the audible range, but they'd probably still be there.
Right, and they might somehow influence us, even if our ears couldn't entirely perceive it or our brain didn't notice that the pattern could be there and could still be having an effect on us.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think this happens in music all the time. There's a lot that's not actually heard. In India, they have a word for it. It's called anahat. It's the unstruck sound. And it's supposed to be the highest, most sophisticated ideal. It's the sound you don't hear.
The different musical traditions that influence you are clearly distinct and separate from each other. Classical European music, experimental electronic music, American jazz, Indian raga. But those styles don't sound separate and distinct in your work. How do you do that? Or how do you view yourself as someone who brings together different genres of music to create something new that partakes of all of them?
Well, I mean, the way I've worked at it is to really try to practice hard each discipline and immerse myself in it, you know, so that it's not just a superficial acquaintance. Of course, it's true that you can't become, you know, perfectly knowledgeable in every field, but if you work at it really hard, if you really take it seriously and say you drop everything you're doing at a time and immerse yourself in Indian music, or drop everything you're doing at the time and work on learning jazz standards, there's something that goes inside your music making factory which helps you to assimilate these things, and they come out kind of naturally then. I think it's just through the discipline of practice that all these things happen. At least that's the way it's worked for me.
That's great. I love the idea of you being a musical factory. So what is the factory working on now? What musical projects, what compositions are you working on or thinking about now?
Well, I usually have more than one thing going on. I mean, I'm always doing raga. That's my daily practice. That's something I very seldom will drop. I get up early in the morning and sing every day. That's kind of like a way to hang on to the ring, you know. One thing that keeps you from floating out into space. But I'm also, you know, during the day I'll be doing practicing piano because I've got some concerts coming up, solo piano concerts and concerts with Gian and concerts with some other musicians back at Bard coming up next month, so I'm spending time now practicing for those. And I'm also spending part of the day writing a new work for Kronos and the Young People's Chorus of New York, which is a chorus that I worked with briefly last April when we did the 45th anniversary concert of NC at Carnegie Hall with Kronos. This Young People's Chorus was involved. So the idea came while we were there for me to write something for them and Kronos, since they worked out so well on the NC concert. And then I'm trying to compose some piano music right now. I think I have, for being a pianist, I haven't written that much music down, so I'm trying to get some of that written and some of my older music notated and writing some new piano music, which I can actually notate at least enough so someone else could play it.
You mentioned your son, Gian, who's a respected composer and performer in his own right. Tell us about your musical collaborations with your son.
Well, Gian is, even though I'm his father, I do have to say he's one of the most extraordinarily talented musicians I've known. And working with him has been a real pleasure because he quickly developed a mastery in improvisation, as a young musician. And so we can, since I'm an improviser too, we can just sit down and start creating music together without having to have too much of a basis to work off of. And I find it's the most intuitive relationship I've had with a musician. I don't know whether that's because, it's genetic or what, but it seems like we're always on a similar wavelength when we're playing together. But it's different enough so that it also opens up, different ideas. One musician might take the lead at one point and one might take it at another. So I like the fact that I don't have to write a lot of things out for him, and he gets it right away what the idea is. And he's also a very good composer, and I've been trying to learn his music. But I'm a little more of a slow learner, so it's harder for me to learn his than just for him to learn mine.
Do you sometimes start off with an improvisation and say, hey, that worked out really well, let's try to remember that and turn that into something?
Yeah. Well, we did. There was a good example of that in a few years back. We were playing in France, and we came out for the second set, and I had written a piece for us to play together. It was just more like a jazz chart or something, but I left the music backstage, and it was just involved enough that I couldn't really remember it without the music, so we just started playing together, and it turned out to be a piece that we haven't actually played it again since then, but it ended up being on an album and got recorded just from that one performance. It turned out so well.
Yeah, and what was the name of that piece?
It was called, let's see. It was named after a restaurant in the town we were playing in, but I can't remember right now. I have to look it up.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
That's okay. Senior moment with my memory.
Well, and you've done enough things that you can't necessarily remember the name of every single one of them and what album they're on.
As soon as we quit talking, it'll come to me.
That happens to me all the time. Well, thank you very much. This has been a very wonderful, enlightening interview. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah, it's been fun for me, too, and I look forward to getting over to Gualala again. That was such a great trip for us last time we were there.
Well, I hope we'll get a chance to hear you and your music sometime soon.
Okay, me too.
Thanks very much.
Okay.